For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on Unlimited Welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on Unlimited Welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.
I'm Dan.
And I'm Alex.
And welcome back to On Air, where we are in beautiful Singapore today.
Live from one of our favorite places, geographically extremely important in aviation, but also forget aviation for a minute, extremely important to us. We both love Singapore.
Exactly.
How's it been going? Just quickly share how our trip has been going so far.
It has been an amazing, I don't know, 14 hours
only,
since
yeah.
we got here.
Yep.
But we had a very fun flight yesterday together yes. on Singapore Airlines.
First time in the regional config of the 787-10. First time for me, at least. And that was interesting to be able to kind of compare it to Singapore Airlines' flagship offering on 350, A380, of course, and all of the new products. I liked it.
I liked it too. I also thought it was fun because obviously the only flight we had taken together until last summer was Lufthansa A320neo.
Yeah.
So I like the progression we're making
of
going from that to Qatar first class to now Singapore Airlines. Let's keep it on this level from now on, okay?
Hopefully. We're on a good track.
Yeah.
The relevance of Singapore, of course, there's a lot going on here at any given time. And also a few things that we are here for that hopefully we can share more details of sometime soon. Probably not too soon, but eventually. So stay tuned, guys.
You make it sound like we're working on launching, I don't know, a podcast.
A bureau.
Yeah.
It's a third host who will join us from Singapore.
Yeah.
No, it's not quite that. But the way in which the landscape has changed in aviation, Singapore has continued to remain extremely relevant. And we were just discussing on our way here, based on some listener Q&A, as to how the landscape has shifted over the last few months, never mind the last few years. And people were asking us to kind of evaluate the state of play. I am amazed at how everything has evolved since the pandemic. We have Singapore Airlines, still one of the world's best carriers. That's the belief of many, including ourselves. and yet they are competing now viciously with carriers that never used to be here, with carriers that have always been here but are now no longer very relevant, and with carriers that have got kind of clever and strategic in trying to take the passengers that Singapore has naturally inherited for so long in newer modern ways. What's happening?
Well, Singapore has always been, but for the past century, a very strategic point of travel, but whether you're going between Australia and Europe or Australia and the Middle East, through Asia to Europe, to Africa, those types of things. So for an airline, this is an excellent location, especially given how Asia is really a booming market in terms of travel. China is, of course, booming. So for Singapore Airlines, that's good in one sense. But as you were hinting, it also means a lot of other airlines want to get in on the party, even if they're not from here.
Yeah.
So for many years, airlines have had mini hubs here, or at least operated Fifth Freedom routes.
Yeah.
But now, I guess, as the aviation market has rematured post-COVID, we have a few new airlines coming in, and as a result, a few old airlines going out. So of course, I think the biggest, most exciting one is the Turkish Airlines, the world's biggest connector, the airline that operates to by far the most destinations, has decided they want to fly to Australia. They don't have the aircrafts to fly direct now, obviously.
Yeah.
So instead, they're flying via Kuala Lumpur and Singapore to Sydney and Melbourne, Australian pronunciation.
Turkish Airlines' decision to set up shop here has arguably driven out Emirates, who used to be here and operate between Australia and Dubai, making that stop here, but also
Singapore, Melbourne,
Fifth Freedom. They're able to operate passengers. If you're not traveling onwards, for example, to Dubai, as you said, you take the Fifth Freedom route between Singapore and Melbourne. They're now no longer here on that because the market continues to shift. The bit that I don't know if it's sustainable is, I mean, we'll go through just who is here playing. Are there enough passengers here for everyone to try to take a slice of this cake, right? Because we've got Turkish who have set up shop here in Singapore now. Of course, you've got the Australian carriers, predominantly Qantas, who have been here and are trying to take hold of the all-important Kangaroo route, partnering up with Emirates to do so. Yeah. Who else do we have? We have all of the Chinese airlines who are saying, swerve Singapore, let us offer you the lowest fare ever on the Kangaroo route and just do a brief stopover in China, perhaps somewhere a passenger has never heard of, right? In a city that a passenger has never heard of, but you're there for an hour, so who cares?
Exactly.
You got back for $400.
Yeah.
Who else?
Well, I just have to, before we get into who else, I think people love, all around the world, Singapore has good name recognition. People like the idea of transiting in Singapore even more than maybe the Middle East or China.
It's Singapore, like a flex in conversations, isn't it?
It is, yeah. And if someone says they transferred in Singapore, it's like, oh, that's nice.
Yeah.
So I think from an airline perspective, it is a good idea, especially given how aviation friendly and non-protectionist Singapore is.
True.
If you're going to operate a Fifth Freedom flight or a Tagon flight, it's a good idea to do it via Singapore.
And isn't it amazing how Singapore, the rest of the world, refuses to learn from how taking that very liberal approach with air travel and allowing so many carriers to set up shop here and operate Fifth Freedom has only benefited Singapore's entire aviation ecosystem and established it as a massive major aviation hub rather than everything else that the other countries perceive the impact to be, which is that, oh, they'll take away passengers and we have to stay protectionist and it's a threat being, you know, liberal and open with that.
Exactly. So some other examples of airlines besides Turkish for the Kangaroo route, we have KLM doing flights from here to Denpasar, Bali. We have Emirates who, although they've abandoned Melbourne, they now do Singapore Phnom Penh and there are many more. So clearly this is, airlines see that opportunity here. And of course, Emirates or KLM are undercutting Singapore Airlines on those routes. And as is a new entrance like Turkish on the Kangaroo route. But I'd say it's a win overall for Singapore. And I think Singapore Airlines doesn't really seem to mind either because they're very confident in what they offer.
They never come across as an entity that feels they're under threat from everyone setting up in their backyard or literally in their home. You're right. It's funny, the other players on the route. So, of course, British Airways have been operating the Kangaroo route for a very long time and they've used Singapore as the stop. In fact, I had a note, right? The first time that the Kangaroo route was ever flown was before BA existed with Imperial Airways. The flight took off in 1935. It took 12 days with multiple overnight stops because the aircraft could not fly during the night due to the lack of night flight navigation systems and so on. So they would fly London to Paris, Paris to Brindisi in Italy. So specific. I mean, Brindisi, had cousins who got married there. Yeah. And then on to Alexandria in Egypt, Baghdad, Karachi, Calcutta, Singapore. So we're talking relevance way back from the first time the Kangaroo route was ever established in 1936. Yeah. And then finally into Australia, Darwin, and then Brisbane, taking a whopping 12 days. Now we're doing it easily. I mean, you can do it nonstop. So BA is still here with such historic importance. Modern day relevance? Zero.
Yeah.
I mean, who
they could leave and no one would even bat an eye. Well, yeah, maybe
they are that person at the party that no one realizes they left.
Exactly. But at the same time, they're also kind of one of the hosts in the sense that you expect to see them there.
Yeah.
For a Brit to think that the national airline doesn't even fly to Australia anymore, I think would be
unusual.
Crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then, of course, on the other end, you have Qantas that is also not hugely relevant in the Kangaroo route if you remove
Despite
Emirates.
Them being the Kangaroo
literally,
on the route.
Yeah. If you remove Emirates from that picture, which is, of course, Qantas' biggest partner to getting people to Europe.
Yeah.
The traffic they operate to and from Singapore is, or even direct to Europe from Perth, is not that significant yet. And you'll notice that all their flights into Singapore are timed so that they all connect to the A380 service they fly to London, which is funny that they connect people through a foreign country to still connect to one of their own flights to get to Europe. But that's the extent of it. Obviously, they don't fly anywhere else in Europe from here like they used to when they sent the 747 to Paris and Frankfurt.
Yeah.
But Qantas should be playing a bigger role on this route shortly, right?
Well, we, so before I come to Qantas, the others that we haven't mentioned, of course, that are massively centering their business around the continued strong demand and the projected demand on this route that overflies us right here in Singapore, or often through Singapore, the Gulf carriers, you know, the elephant in the room here, the Gulf carriers are hoping that you as passengers don't stop in Singapore. There are many that, I mean, there's many casual conversations that people have when promoting the choice to take a Gulf carrier, in that at least if you're leaving Australia, the big long haul flight is first, right? So then by the time you reach the Middle East, you're practically a couple hours away from at least Eastern Europe. Right?
From an Australian perspective,
if you are leaving Australia, exactly. Not the case for the other way around. The Gulf carriers have always said that this is predominantly one of their most important markets, and that we continue to see how it's this, you know, fiercely competitive landscape that keeps having to evolve. Emirates with Qantas, we said, Etihad less so in recent years. Previously, you know, it was the A380 debuted with London and Sydney, and it was all of the new products. And I actually flew it from Sydney, Abu Dhabi, Abu Dhabi, London.
Right. And now,
all the way through.
Now, ironically, they're sending their A380 here to Singapore, but not to Australia.
So, yeah. And then, of course, Qatar, very famously, and we've discussed on the podcast, wanted this greater market access into Australia, justifying as well that Australians needed more competition to reduce fares. We know that the Australian government, kind of colluding with Qantas a bit, have blocked that initial application. Fast forward to today, Qatar is very much having now an in Australia, buying a 25% stake in Virgin Australia to do so. So we're not talking about anything cheap here, but now they get that expanded footprint with Virgin Australia flights, albeit a wet lease from Qatar. It all ties up. Virgin Australia now will be relevant again with the Kangaroo
connections
route,
to Europe,
with connections to Europe. They have a relationship with Singapore Airlines.
That
relationship is continuing, by the way. So where Virgin Australia have been forced to end it with Etihad because they are now in bed with another Gulf carrier, it's going to continue with Singapore Airlines. How's that going to work?
Well, I think it's smart from an airline perspective to have multiple partners for such a long, important journey as the Kangaroo route.
Yeah.
And if you think about it, we have airlines all the way from Europe to basically Japan and Korea. Every airline in between, from the Middle East, India, China, they're all trying to compete for traffic on this route.
Yeah.
Obviously these regions are incredibly far apart, but there's nowhere else in the world where you have such a variety of different airlines trying to get in on the cash.
Trying to get in on the same, you know, number of passengers. There are only so many people doing this journey.
Yeah. Yeah, it's which is quite interesting in itself that it's such a prized possession for airlines. And of course, Australia especially is very protectionist, as we've said. So they don't want to, for some reason, see fares go too low.
Yeah.
But
the way in which carriers like BA have become less relevant here, for example, or along the Kangaroo route, again, potentially justified by the fact that they are far more money-making and far more prioritizing of perhaps the world's only $1 billion air travel route, the Atlantic, the transatlantic, the routes, let's say, between London and New York.
Yeah, exactly. And this kind of brings us to something we've been hinting at in the past few episodes, that airlines are very nervously and actively monitoring the demand across the Atlantic on both sides. US airlines have obviously come out with slightly concerning statements about their projections for 2025.
Do you not think that the concerning statements they're not concerning statements, are they? As you said, they're kind of hinting at, just make sure the market's expectations are not too high on us. Do you think that is because of the uncertainty that they are now facing owing to tariffs, you know, fears of a recession, all of that?
Yeah, tariffs and just general economic uncertainty.
Yeah.
Prices have kept going up in the US.
Yeah.
And so far, airlines seem to say demand hasn't changed.
Mm.
In fact, demand is very strong. We saw Air France KLM say that basically they could charge any prices this summer and flights will still be full across the Atlantic. Swiss has said the same, that demand is incredibly strong still. But we do have signs from Air Canada, although not overt, just small traffic cuts here and there. Yeah. Like I was reading about a lot of Air Canada Rouge routes being cut, downgraded from
E3. Known as Air Canada Rogue.
Yes, which should be their real name. But they've been cutting a lot of flights from A321s to A319s on US routes for the upcoming summer. So,
oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. Obviously, they don't want to or shouldn't cut their routes completely. But we have these signs. And for airlines that are so heavily invested in transatlantic, even British Airways, Lufthansa Group, Air France KLM, sure, they fly a lot to Asia. Transatlantic is most important and most profitable. Mm. Then we have airlines like Aer Lingus, where their only business is flying across the Atlantic, you know?
Just that way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it will be interesting to see how things change in that regard and if more emphasis will be placed eventually on flights to the east.
I just think as a whole, the threat to the lot of them collectively, if I had to choose the main threat going forward, and this is what we were asked about earlier, one of the listeners sent in a question, I think it continues to be the Chinese carriers. Yeah. I think that no matter what, no matter who appears to be in a slightly better position in the game of the battle of the kangaroo route and how it's segmented across the region, the continent, I think that the Chinese carriers present by far the most kind of specific headache financially for airlines, just in the way that they are able to dump that capacity at the lowest fares. We discussed all of the players that are trying to connect Europe with Australia and everywhere in between. And yet Qantas also have this idea that, guys, we're going to cut all of you out of the picture and we're going to take them nonstop.
Yeah.
We have the aircraft to go nonstop from Australia to London. I mean, I don't know. Did you think that by 2025 we would have had a better take up of ultra, ultra long haul nonstop flights by now? Because it hasn't changed since they started.
It is interesting when you think about it. And the fact that British Airways doesn't seem to be interested in this.
No.
No other European carriers.
They set up a task force to study if this is something that they should ultimately start thinking about.
Yeah, invest. And the answer
is there was no outcome. So I can only assume that the answer wasn't anything that, you know, had them start suggesting that this was the direction of travel for BA.
So we get a lot of questions about supersonic flight.
Yeah.
I feel like Project Sunrise, what Qantas is calling the flights between Australia and Europe and the US, East Coast, is basically sort of the equivalent to that. It's taking the top of each market, the top economy class flyers who are willing to pay the most, top business class flyers, top first class, but there's never going to be a huge market for that. The same as New York to Singapore, which is operated by Singapore Airlines. It has two daily flights, but it's not like US carriers are suddenly interested in launching that as well, because when you have these ultra long haul flights, there is so much competition with connections where they're guaranteed to be able to undercut on price, especially Chinese carriers. But just operating a 20, 21 hour flight like these will be is more expensive by nature than operating two 10 hour flights due to higher takeoff weight, because you're carrying more fuel. The cabin crew,
it costs more.
Yeah, the pilots, the cabin crew, in so many ways. So, of course, this is very exciting, but I don't think it's a complete game changer for the kangaroo route.
Yeah,
what are game changers are airlines like the Chinese, or I think increasingly we'll see the Indian airlines. So not only Air India.
Of course, we didn't mention Air India also playing a big role in this route.
And presumably very soon, Indigo will want to be part of this, which I think will create a bit of a price war in
India.
And
then you've got Thai, Malaysia, Vietnam.
Exactly.
You know, you have all of these that also feel that they can cash in on, even if it's a slight detour to the right. Journey time, given the Earth is a sphere, and our listeners know that because you're not flat earthers. they're able to offer very similar journey times and, you know, end-to-end timing wise for anyone doing that big route. So
exactly.
It's just interesting for me, the amount airlines continue to bet on this being so fundamental. We wouldn't see the likes of Qatar buy 25% of Virgin Australia, which only barely, you know, Virgin Australia is just recently profitable.
Yeah.
And it is now financially sound and of decent governance and so on. But that was a big commitment from their side to gain that market access into a country that they know demand will continue to remain strong. Sometimes I wonder if it's because Aussies get the benefit of the fact that they can have two summers, right?
Yeah.
And so they just go for the Europe summer. So there's this constant, you know, there's always a desire for Australia, for the rest of the world, for all that Australia has to offer. But it's that guaranteed way that they call it, Aussies call it the Euro summer, where you just know that requirement for them to leave in June, July, August is always going to be there.
Yeah. But actually, the more I talk about this, the more I'm shocked by the amount of demand, especially outbound from Australia, because they have like a population of 30 million, which
left after all, they're all these aircraft.
Yeah, I know. But the thing is, I've flown the Kangaroo route once in one direction. Any other time I've been to Australia or New Zealand, it's been after a week or two in Asia or the Middle East, that kind of thing. I've only done the full journey once, which was to Oslo.
Okay.
And after that, I was a mess for a week. The time changed, the length of the trip. I'm like, this is not something I want to be doing.
Yeah.
If I lived in Australia, I might go once a year to visit my family, but I would much rather go to the US. Short time difference, direct flight, or to Asia on vacation. Yeah, but
you're changing the whole destination,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, my point is just, I know that the whole Euro summer thing has very good marketing in Australia. And I've heard that a lot of people even take out loans.
Oh, wow.
To be able to take this,
what
to many is a once in a lifetime trip. But I'm just like, guys, there are so many other cool places to explore closer by, you know?
Well, the airlines are not sharing that point of view. I
mean, just come to Singapore. You don't need to connect onwards.
Well, okay, so let's talk about Singapore Airlines now, right? And just zoom in a little bit on their direction. So they had a decent quarter three in terms of their results. Their next full year financial results for the last year will be published sometime in May. They launched their current cabin products, which are enjoyed by many on the A380, 350s, and other aircraft, back in 2017. I didn't realize how that is almost 10 years ago. I mean, I know I didn't realize, of course I realized, but it just doesn't feel like it, right? Yeah. Singapore will be launching an entire newer range of cabin products, economy, premium economy, business, and suites all over again next year. Again, that's them knowing that, okay, time to elevate, time to go one up in that race, time to reposition once again and securing themselves for the future air travel demand via this wonderful little city state. What do we expect? Is it going to be, what's left to do on a commercial aircraft? I just can't imagine how they're going to try to raise the industry benchmark again. Yeah.
Singapore Airlines is also interesting in that regard, because besides first class or suites, I don't feel that they've ever really been an airline to push the boundary to a new level of what we expect in a cabin class.
Right.
They're a bit more conservative. They want to
play it a bit safer, right?
Yes. Because they know that the race of having the best seat, you can't win, because you introduce one seat,
the next
6 months later, a new airline introduces something better.
Yeah.
So they want to go with good and consistent, which they do, but I don't expect something that's even as good as the best we have in the world now.
Okay.
I just think it will be a fantastic seat with some really solid improvements, probably a door and people not having to flip the seat over to sleep diagonally, that kind of thing.
Yeah, but they kind of fixed that with the
A380.
With the current one on the A380,
which, I mean, the interesting thing is they've been taking delivery of A350 after A350 with that other seat that flips over.
Still with the flip one.
So that seat is only on the A380. And that's a very nice seat. But even in first class, actually, as we start to see that on the 777X, the A350 that goes to New York and the US, I even think that is not quite going to be something mind-blowing.
Mm.
hopefully they prove me wrong.
Yeah.
But I just think they're in a position where they fly from a very high yield market to very high yield markets. And they don't need to have the best of the best.
Yeah.
And we were actually having this interesting discussion earlier about why do Singaporeans, compared to so many other people around the world living in cities that are home to five-star airlines or very high-quality airlines, why do specifically Singaporeans seem to love Singapore Airlines as much as they do when you have other parts of the world where people have great airlines that foreigners love, but they only seem to be dissatisfied or complain about
them? There's that weird kind of relationship that in many countries the national carrier ends up having with the local population there or the nationals there, which is kind of like more on the hate end rather than the love end, right? Like they complain, they, you know, they seem to feel they have a better relationship, that the grass is greener with the national carrier next door rather than their own. That's not the case here, as you said.
Yeah. Actually, it's very interesting in the Middle East because we know people who live in, for example, Kuwait or Bahrain.
Yeah.
And they only fly Qatar Airways or Emirates.
Yeah.
So they don't love, forget, those airlines.
Qatar Airways is perhaps the biggest, it is the biggest major international airline of Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, that's, you know, right. And Emirates is...
Right. And so they huge. Are so, I mean, look at, with Riyadh Air coming up and thinking they're going to take them on. It's funny, a lot of people think that, oh, they're competing with the Doha and Dubai hubs. Actually, they're going to be competing with the Gulf carriers that are already absolutely present as if they are hubbed there in Saudi Arabia. And Riyadh Air are going to have an incredibly tough time taking any passengers away from, because they have so many loyalists in the neighboring countries that have got slightly weaker airlines. Like, let's ignore Riyadh for a minute because they don't exist yet. But
Saudia,
we understand why anyone seeking out something a little more luxe, a little more extra, something perhaps a bit more comfortable, they're assessing that the neighboring Gulf countries offer more. Of course, Kuwait, very understandable. Kuwait has got a limited route network as well. So the other carriers don't just appear to be better, but they're also an enabler by being able to take them to destinations they can't reach from Kuwait. Bahrain, same exact thing.
Yeah.
Oman, unfortunately, shrinking beyond belief, despite the fact that Oman arguably having perhaps the best home destination of all the Gulf carriers. And if anyone hasn't been to Oman, I encourage you to go. Oman is absolutely incredible, perhaps one of the most beautiful countries on earth.
It is.
So what is it? I mean,
I think it, so let's use the example of Qatar.
Yeah.
People all around the world love Qatar Airways, but from what I hear, Qataris manage to find stuff be dissatisfied about anyway.
They often complain.
Yeah.
And sometimes perspective is required, right? Because when you have a population that is used to such a high service airline, with an airline boasting, you know, new aircraft and state-of-the-art lounges and blah, blah, blah. And this is true of much of the Gulf. So I think we can pair Qatar and the UAE, for example, with this, the UAE being home to both Emirates and Etihad.
And Air Arabia and Fly Dubai. We're
talking about the legacy ones, right? The big boys, right? So when you have the population so used to and accustomed to the home carrier that is of such high standard, suddenly the complaints start pouring in about things that are absolutely the norm in Europe. In fact, in Europe, it's 10 million times worse. The US don't even get us started. There are many scenarios where I hear examples and I think, okay, I need you to live in Germany for 4 weeks and have Lufthansa try to take care of your requirements or your complaints, whether it was that, you know, the gate was too far away, or that you arrived on a remote stand, or that you felt that the meal that was a la carte, dine on demand, and was lobster wasn't tasty enough on that occasion. In that scenario, you know, the European airlines wouldn't respond. They would laugh.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, and so I think it's just about what you're used to. I don't often blame them for not, for in any of these examples that we've said, for not exactly knowing what's out there and why actually that complaint maybe isn't so worthy of being a complaint. Yeah. But
I mean, I think that's so funny now that you say that, because there was this forum, I think, during the weekend or end of last week, where United CEO Scott Kirby was making some comments about, obviously United is trying to compete with Delta and be one of the premium airlines in the US. Mm. So he was saying, you know, I don't think American Airlines will be a successful premium airline because there's only room for two premium airlines in the US. So that he means is United and Delta. But I was just like, I would have loved to be in that room when he goes, you know, we only have room for two premium airlines here. And I'd be like, are they in the room with us right now? I don't think so. Yeah. Like the way they talk about it, the way Delta and United talk about being premium airlines, I'm like, you are delusional.
But they are, because we discussed it when we were in Korea, didn't we? About why is there such reluctance of the rest of the world? We're not saying to copy. We're saying to keep an open mind and to learn, to know that there are better ways of doing X, Y, Z, and they don't have to figure it out by themselves. They can choose to learn from the very airlines that, guess what, they partner with.
Yeah.
You know, and yet they ignore these partnerships, and it's such a valid point.
But that's why it just cracks me up to have United flying to Dubai,
yeah,
and American flying to Doha,
yeah,
and thinking, what do these passengers, locals, think as they board? And they have been complaining about Qatar or Emirates. They get on and they go, oh, okay, like, where's my hotel? It's literally Jennifer Aniston in the Emirates.
Yeah, yeah,
we don't have that here.
Yeah, there's no showers here. There's yeah, no bar. What are you going to wear to the van? There's no bar. You don't need to wear anything because there's no bar.
But they just think it's an A380 because they're going to New York.
Yeah.
Let's go all the way back to Singapore, because why do Singaporeans not feel that way about Singapore Airlines? I think a big part of that is not only the huge amount of competition here, but the fact that there's the contrast between Scoot, which everyone knows is Singapore Airlines owned. It's part of the same group.
It's the 100% owned low-cost airline subsidiary of the wider Singapore Airlines group.
Exactly.
Flying short-haul, long-haul, and everywhere in between.
Yeah, and once you've taken a long-haul flight on Scoot, you will never complain about Singapore Airlines again.
Maybe that's the strategy.
Yeah.
Maybe the strategy is to keep them worlds apart.
They are worlds apart.
Scoot is the enabler in terms of driving lower fares and offering cheap air travel.
Yeah.
Not much else.
Yeah,
right?
I mean, it's just so demeaning. Like, Singapore Airlines have their beautiful, elegant outfits. The crew are like, they've been put in a machine where their hair was perfectly done. Everything
perfectly
is tipped up.
French twisted.
Yeah, and then you board Scoot, and it's like, today you will be served by your Scooties as we fly.
Scooties.
That's what they call the cabin crew. So they're just
trying to Scoot quite a bit.
Yeah, quite a bit.
Yeah.
And they just try to separate them in every way possible. They try to make the clothes look like something you pulled off a rack in IKEA. Meanwhile, Singapore Airlines is the most elegant. So I think that's part of the strategy. And then also, by being unapologetically premium in every step. So you don't say, for example, oh, but the flight to Copenhagen is not as high yield or as important as the flight to London, or whatever the route, whether you're flying to Phuket, which is obviously overwhelmingly leisure, or to Bangkok, you'll have the exact same in-flight experience, which I think says a lot when you're so committed to consistency and consistently just charging more than your competitors because you know you offer a high quality all around experience. That is what, you know, cements Singapore Airlines as just quality from top to bottom.
Yeah. Their full year results, as I said, are going to be published in May. And I think that the expectation is that it's not going to be as strong as last year.
Yeah.
And that's down to a few reasons. Demand has weakened for Singapore Airlines in some markets, that's for sure. As an airline, they don't forecast, but the demand is not consistent across the board. And that's true for multiple carriers. They did have, as I said, a good Q3. And the expectation is that the results will be better still than what everyone compares to as a very, very good year. And the last very, very good year, apart from us riding the wave of massive recovery in 2022 and 2023, the last normal very good year, of course, was 2019. So I think the results are set to be better even then. But you commented on how the airline CEOs that we're hearing from, they've started to do their kind of pre-earnings interviews on networks like BBC and CNN are hinting that demand may not be as strong. I think we shouldn't kid ourselves in that aircraft are still incredibly full. Load factors are still performing very, very well. For many airlines this year, they will announce once again their best ever record profits for 2024. And if there was a period of uncertainty in that there could have been reduced demand, we've just passed it. It was in the Northern Hemisphere. It was the end of 2024. And this first little quarter of 2025, that winter period, when I spoke to many airline chief executives, that's the bit where they said demand was probably going to finally dip and they weren't looking forward to that. Now, why was it going to dip? 2022, incredibly strong all throughout pandemic recovery. 2023, that recovery continued straight on through. 2024, it started to level off a bit, but was again rescued by the fact that summer arrived by March and you had a very, very strong summer, April, May, June, July, right through to the end of October. So really, beginning from the pandemic, it took until October 2024, just months ago, for airlines to think, I think things may have run out of steam now. I think that the forecasts indicate that demand will slightly start to weaken. No more passengers traveling on their vouchers. No one using the bookings that were from 2 years prior. The hoarding of miles and points and the extensions of their validity and so on. But it was just a short few months. And the CEOs that I've spoken to said they got through it just fine. And guess what? They're now ready for a massive booming summer, which arguably begins in a matter of weeks. And so when the airline CEOs that we hear from in the US start to hint about their concerns about demand, I think in this scenario now, it is less about the global shift and the global travel dynamics and far more about their own uncertainty in markets like the US, where they just have no idea what is going to happen with everything that the new Trump admin are coming in and doing with the economy.
Exactly. Very interesting analysis. I feel like we need to be loyal to our listeners and do quite a bit of Q&A today.
Let's do
it. To get some of that out of the way. So let's do it. So we are starting out with a question from Benjamin on YouTube,
okay,
who has been commenting on every single short we've posted.
Nice.
So thank you to him for supporting. By the way, quick reminder, we now have an Instagram account where we're posting the best snippets from our episodes.
From the show.
Check it out, On Air with Dan and Alex.
So that's at On Air with Dan and Alex.
Exactly.
Full name of the podcast. Yeah. Got it.
So Benjamin asks, inspired by our discussion when we were in Korea about retro liveries,
okay,
what do we think is our personal favorite retro livery and least favorite retro livery? And by the way, it just makes me think, why does Singapore Airlines not have a retro livery?
Yeah, that's so true. Why? Okay, we need to message them.
Yeah, but as we've said, they're very conservative. So that's probably the explanation. They don't want any different special livery, that kind of thing.
Let's think.
Honestly, besides the BA 747 special liveries, which we don't have anymore, but were amazing.
That was going to be my answer.
Yeah.
It was the best.
Yeah, they really were amazing. I love Qatar's 777 retro livery.
Okay, with the cheat
line. Alpha 7, Bravo Alpha Charlie.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, that's a very nice
good
one.
Memory.
And, yeah. Like, it's funny how rare retro liveries are in Asia, now that I think about it. It's more of a European kind of thing.
Yeah.
The US care. American has quite a few retro liveries.
Yeah.
United has a few. American obviously has.
I can't think of the worst. What's the worst?
I mean, I feel like there's a lot of bad regular liveries.
Yeah. I can think of bad regular liveries.
Yeah. Okay. One that I think American does have some that are pretty ugly.
Okay. Fair enough. I can't think off the top of my head, so I'll leave that one. Antonio has written in and said, hey guys, Delta published their new updates following a launch event in the Sphere at Vegas. By the way, did you see that?
No.
Yeah, they had this massive event a while back at the Sphere where they unveiled kind of the updates to their in-flight entertainment, the app, product offering, and so on.
Was it the world's most premium?
Well, hold on, event. Listen to this. So he said, Delta published their new updates with a launch event in the Sphere. At the Sphere in Vegas, and refer to themselves, and he's attached the PDF where they've also put this on the as part of their announcement, as the world's best airline. He's but who decided that Delta is the world's best airline? Antonio, the answer is really clear. Antonio, I'll address you directly. Delta is not the world's best airline by any means, and it is entirely of their own decision to refer to themselves as such, but it is frankly not true.
Delta, if anything, is the world's most delusional airline. If they're going to put something in their menus on their in-flight magazine, let it be that. Because the fact that they, even in a US context, think
they're so amazing. I would love it if they had the goal of becoming that, right? Like that would be a bit humble of them.
Exactly. Which, to be fair, I hear their Delta One lounges are incredible, even by international business class standards.
Good.
But the problem is, in the service, the food, the seats,
the aircraft. We would be here all day.
Yeah, literally everything else is a problem. Yeah. So it's just so funny how they keep insisting they're so premium. It's like one of those things when you have to keep telling people you are something, you're not actually that. So as much as you can tell the public, and a lot of Americans seem to believe that Delta is the best thing since sliced bread.
Yeah.
As soon as you fly an international carrier, you're going to realize that's not really the case.
Yeah.
I will say US airlines are not bad. Mm. At least United and Delta. American is not terrible either, but the way that some people think they really are amazing. And let's say you're flying from the US to Asia. Choosing United or Delta
would be crazy.
Is literal insanity.
Yeah. So that's mad.
Yeah.
I've got a question here that links to our earlier discussion from Zena. She put, noticing that Qantas and Qatar are in the same alliance, how could Qantas have been comfortable with Qatar now signing this big deal for Virgin Australia? And she's put in brackets, I'm not complaining, as we need lower fares here in Oz. The quick answer to that, of course, is that it's not that Qantas allowed something to happen. It's that arguably Qantas were the architect in pushing an airline like Qatar to partner up with Qantas's own Aussie rival Virgin Australia because of all the collusion with the government to try to keep them out. So they kept them out. The plan failed. Qatar found a way. It bought up 25% and will now bolster Qantas's domestic rival in Australia. And now Virgin Australia gets to have its day and its moment flying long haul with and on the behalf of and directly with the long haul giant that is Qatar. So I don't know if Qantas had actually ever seen this coming.
Yeah.
You know, I'm just thinking in my head, Qantas obviously is an acronym, right? It's not an actual word. It's an acronym for the Queensland, blah, 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 blah.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
I want to get it right.
Okay.
It's
no way.
Yeah. Qantas acronym. Here we go. Qantas.
Quirky.
No, it's Queensland and Northern Territory Aerial Services.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. Good to know.
So what I was thinking is Qantas and Qatar are perhaps the only two words in modern language with the Q without the U.
Yes.
Right. Even though Qantas is, of course, an acronym, as I said, it's funny that they have so much in common, these two airlines that hate each other.
Yeah. It makes me think of, we both watched The Apprentice, the movie, on the flight yesterday.
Yes. We watched this. Just to explain, it's not The Apprentice, the British TV series.
It's a semi-biographical movie about Donald Trump's
early years.
And there were a lot of takeaways from the movie, but one of them that Trump learned from his mentor Roy Cohn is that most things in the world are not about what it appears to be about, like what's the matter at hand. It's more about what's going on between the people behind the matter.
Right.
That's what matters.
Right.
So I think in the case of Qantas and Qatar / Qantas and Emirates, even though Qantas and Qatar are in the same alliance, it probably comes down a lot to the relationships that were there. And there seemed to be bad blood between, obviously, previous Qatar Airways CEO, Akbar Abubakar, and Alan Joyce, previous Qantas CEO, for a long time. And for some reason, I guess Alan Joyce just loved the team at Emirates. That has led to these massive ramifications for the entire Australian flying public.
Well, it's funny, isn't it? Because arguably, you know, one could argue that Qantas perhaps had little respect for the brothers and sisters in the One World Alliance, even back then, when it would have been unusual that you had all these alliance members, including two in the Middle East, not even just one. And yet you know, they very comfortably ignored the alliance and decided that commercially it was better to do business outside of the alliance with Emirates. What I know is that when the Virgin Australia deal was about to go through, many of the Oneworld CEOs and many of the Oneworld airlines were trying to kind of talk up rhetoric of how perhaps Qatar shouldn't, if the rumors to be were to be believed, perhaps Qatar shouldn't move forward with Virgin Australia because it's in partnership with Qantas. And so it should, and it's like, hold on a second. Qantas had absolutely no regard of the alliances. Now that's not just the Qantas thing. And I, in some ways I don't blame them because this is the aviation sector right now. I think the role of alliances has become much, much smaller in terms of its, in terms of importance. And we're seeing airlines just commercially assess what's best.
Yeah.
Singapore do it. You know, they are in Star Alliance, but they're more than happy to go find, for example, Virgin Australia.
Yeah.
And they also partner up with them because they know that they can access a greater feed in Australia. Meanwhile, Virgin Australia get better access to Southeast Asia.
Exactly. Yeah. The role of alliances is just getting diminished, but perhaps the whole Qantas Emirates thing was at the start of that.
Maybe.
That was the first beginning
move.
Of the downfall, so to speak. I have a message here from Owen who says, I've had it. I love that.
Okay.
I've had it with people hating on Ryanair. This might be a hot take, but I think the Ryanair social media team has easily won me over and has managed to take a cost-cutting, low-cost carrier into a lovable and memeable company. Besides, as long as you know what you're booking, you should be okay with the fact that your 10 euro ticket doesn't include a carry-on seat or seat selection. I 100% agree.
I think they are doing very well on social media.
And I think
people are deliberately choosing the seat 11A with no window.
Yeah.
Just to go viral.
And
they want
to
be roasted by Ryanair.
Yeah.
I mean, imagine that Ryanair have unlocked something unusual in that they've cracked the code to offering 10 euro fares. And now they've cracked the code to people wanting to sit at a window seat with no window just to get online roasted by Ryanair social media.
Yeah. And I just think it's completely hilarious how we have an airline entirely dependent on B2C, business to customer transactions, completely roasting their customers in every chance they have.
They go personal.
Yeah. They call people ugly.
They call people ugly. Yeah. They check. They're like, you know, nodding that sweater, or like whatever. You know, they go to, if the comment has come, for example, via Instagram, where the individual has multiple photos, they like take a photo from his Instagram and they're like, you know, let's say the passenger says something about them being unhappy, they'll say, as unhappy as your girlfriend in your pictures from Tenerife. And it's like, how does an airline get away with it? But if there's one airline that can get away with it, is Ryanair.
100%. And we should also not forget how valuable Ryanair has been for Europe as a whole.
Yeah,
for the
it's
market.
An enabler. It's a massive enabler for air travel. Anyone pioneering in the way that they have to offer sustainably extremely low fares deserves to be applauded. And also, there are very few horror stories that come out of Ryanair.
Yeah.
In terms of, you know.
And it's always that person's fault. If someone is saying, I had to pay £60 to check in at the airport or whatever.
You should have read the TNC.
Oscar and I have had to do that because I forgot to check in.
But
I don't blame Ryanair.
There's no hope for anyone else.
Yeah. I mean, maybe there's more likelihood I'll forget because I'm taking so many flights all the time.
Oh, you mean because it wasn't an airline with a suite, so you just didn't know what to do with yourself.
I didn't want to check in. That was the real
key. You were so reluctant to fly. Daniel, check in. There's only 3 days left. You're like, I don't want to.
literally. But then we had to bite the bullet, pay 60 euros per person to check in at the airport. But it's like, I'm not angry at the airline because I know my flight was 20 euros to begin with.
Yeah.
And I'm the one who didn't do what you're supposed to when flying with them. So all these people who get upset, you know, I think Ryanair is quite fair. It clearly discloses everything.
I do think it is fair. It's also a pretty semi-clean website experience in that it's not confusing as long as you actually read and it's worth reading because they're telling you a lot of information that if you decide to not follow it, you'll be charged like what you were.
Yeah.
But also, you know, when they hit the headlines, Ryanair, about, you know, chaos on board Ryanair flight because of blah, 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 99.9% of the time, drunk passengers.
Yeah.
Right. So, and again, that's not really anything to do with the airline itself. So
exactly. Here's a nice question since we've been traveling together from Sam. asking, how do you manage your sleep while traveling the world creating your YouTube videos?
Oh.
But we'll both answer.
Okay.
Then I actually met Noel Phillips a couple of months ago in the Emirates inaugural. So he quotes Noel, and I learned this from Noel as well when I met him.
Okay.
I watched Noel Phillips too, and he mentioned recently that he stays on US time wherever he travels, which he does. So even if it's
Is he 2 based in PM, the US?
Yeah, he's based in Texas now.
Okay.
So even if he's in Asia or the Middle East where it's 2 PM, if it's nighttime in Houston or I think he lives around there, he'll sleep.
No.
But this is when he's on a review trip. So obviously not on vacation, I think. Yeah, just like flying around. But what are our... So first of all, you can answer what your tricks are.
Well, I just slept terribly in Korea for 4 nights. And it wasn't really because of jet lag. The first night, obviously, is always a bit... And we said, okay. I said to you, I think I'm going to be fine because I was super tired anyway. And I kind of know myself that I'll sleep through. Classic first night anywhere as far east as Korea, okay? I slept about 10:30. And then at midnight, I woke up and I was like,
good morning, Baltimore.
Yeah, good morning, South Korea. Yeah. I looked over and I was looking at it and it said like 12:30, you know, just gone midnight. And I was thinking, oh, so I was a bit delusional in jet lag. Yeah. I was like, oh, so what time is that in Korea? Yeah. No, I'm in Korea. That is the time. Okay. So managed to fall back to sleep. Fine. Then proceeded to sleep terribly for the next 3 nights because the room was so hot. I think the key to answer the question specifically is so long as I can sleep in a dark, cold room, then the first thing I do is adjust to the time zone that I'm going to, even if I'm only there for a couple of days. Just adjust as quickly as I can. And then, you know, touch wood. Seem to be okay.
Yeah, that's interesting, actually, because Oscar and I had been, for example, we went skiing in Bulgaria about, a while ago. We had come from Asia and we knew we were going back.
Mm.
So we actually sort of decided to stay on a hybrid time zone where we would wake up before skiing every day at like 4:30 a.m.
Okay.
Just for fun, we would read, we would get ready, we'd be at breakfast the second it opened, so everything was fresh.
That's quite satisfying.
Every single day, no one has touched this. Yeah.
That's easy to do. Sorry, traveling west.
Yeah.
That's easier to do going west.
Exactly. So that's why we did go west. Yeah. It was just wonderful. Then after getting back from the slopes, we basically fall asleep at 7:38.
I mean, you do that when you're skiing, even if you haven't traveled far. Yeah. Skiing is exhausting.
Yeah. But the great thing is that then we go back east.
Yeah.
And the time change, instead of, I don't know, 4 or 5 hours, ends up being only 2 for our body, which is really good. So I like doing those kind of, maybe not transitioning completely, but somewhere in between.
Mm.
And then if I'm on a review trip, like I also do it sometimes, like Noel does, I'll just try to stay as close as to the time zone I know I'm going to go to.
Yeah.
Obviously, if it's daytime and I'm in a city I love, I'm not just going to sleep because I'm going to the US.
That's why what you described sounded awful because you know how much I value and prioritize daylight. I also think daylight, actually, to answer the question, has a massive impact.
Yeah.
You need to be able to see daylight just for your body to subconsciously understand and then better adjust. It is so important. I remember, I can't remember where I was the first time I ever went to Australia. Maybe we were in a mall and I was actively searching for the window just to remind my body it wasn't the middle of the night. It was kind of late morning. It's weird how psychologically that plays a massive role.
Exactly.
That's why airlines have invested in all that mood lighting.
Yeah. And one of the worst things is taking off at night, flying through a day and then landing. Taking off in dark again.
Which is or what landing we just dark. Had going to Korea.
Yeah, almost. Yeah, almost. Getting almost. Out of the airport.
Thankfully, if you get out of the airport fast, you get a bit of light.
Exactly. So final question here from Javier. Well, we've got questions from him before, but every time I get the name wrong.
Xavier, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, Xavier. Sorry, Xavier.
Yeah.
He says, hi, Dan. Love your podcast with Alex. In parentheses, Alex will love this. I was wondering if you guys have considered discussing stopovers on the podcast and the benefit that some airlines are offering, such as free hotels and or tours for qualifying tickets or customers. Would love to hear your perspective on it.
I think it's an excellent way to show off the destination that otherwise passengers wouldn't book to travel to. So this is particularly key for hubs.
Yeah.
And Singapore is very much a destination where we are now, whereas the Gulf hubs are not. So I think for them, it's much more important. And the same can be applied and extended to places like Istanbul, and they can leverage that there. Potentially a conversation to have with the Chinese carriers. to, I know China have relaxed a bit with their exit transit visa. So it's definitely an excellent strategy if the airline can harmonize well with the state tourism board to ensure that it is seamless. Because if it's not seamless, it's stressful. Yeah. And no passenger needs additional stress when they're already trekking from one side of the world to the other.
No, those airlines that make you go to a desk after you land to do some stopover
thing. Say hi, like, can I see your country?
Yeah, or like, can I book my stopover hotel now?
Yeah.
I'm like, I'm not going to land at either 10 p.m. or 6 a.m. Go and stand in line at a desk to see if I'll get a hotel. That's not what I want to do.
Yeah.
I love how Qatar Airways does it. They let you book in advance. You know, I've taken advantage of it several times. Yeah. Booking like a...
That's when you've come and we've recorded when you've been on a stopover before.
I've stayed in like five-star hotels for $15 a night.
US dollars.
Which is great.
That's, again, that example of it being subsidized because there is that greater harmonization between the airline and the state tourism.
Exactly.
Yeah. So if airlines can do that as well, but there's so many markets that are untouched and don't bother to do it.
Yeah.
And
everywhere should do it. Yeah.
They should, because I actually think if you have the time and you're not on something like annual leave or, you know, it's not a pressing issue, if you're stopping anywhere, you know, 80% of the time, you should probably see where you're stopping.
Exactly.
Because 80% of the time, it's likely to be somewhere that you will never travel to.
Yeah.
So you're there. So go explore for, even if it's for 6 hours and then come back.
Yeah, exactly.
It's worth it.
Good conclusion. So on that note, you guys, we want to remind you to leave a review for the podcast, whether you're listening on Spotify or Apple. If you're listening on YouTube, maybe go over to Spotify or Apple and leave a review. Send us a screenshot of your review or rating, and we'll be entering you to give a few, or to win a few very nice amenity kits.
And as always, we thank you for joining us. New episodes are out wherever you get your podcasts every Wednesday, including here on YouTube, we're on Spotify, we're on Apple. And also you can see reels from the podcast of the best bits and highlights on our new Instagram at On Air with Dan and Alex. I nearly wanted to change the username for Alex first just to balance it out a bit. But
I don't know
for
about
consistency,
that.
I decided against it.
Yeah, you did.
I did.
All right. Well, on that note, we will see you all next week on air. Bye-bye.
See you later from Singapore.
Owning a boat comes with a number of perks, like being able to fling your favorite fishing rod around. And here's another perk. GEICO's boat insurance covers your boat and your belongings. And with specialist support from agents that are as passionate about boating as you are, there's so much value that you'll want to high-five someone. But not while you're holding your fishing rod. That's a prized possession. So hold on tight with both hands and keep it covered through boat insurance. Get more with GEICO.